Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Really, 007. Hello and welcome to the Really 007 podcast for a very special interview. My name's Rob Parker. I'm joined by John Kell and Christopher Goldie. And we're three sixes, a half of the usual.
A half, exactly.
Great. I'm a numbers guy. I'm a word guy, sorry, not a numbers guy. Of the, yeah, we're half of the Really 007 six. And we're here tonight to speak to someone very special who's got a very interesting role in the world of James Bond. But before we meet this gentleman, please check us out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all the usual places that you go and get your podcasts. Give us 5 stars on your subscription service of choice. And chat to us on Twitter at Really007Pod. Do we have an email address? Really007@gmail.something? Do we do that?
.com.
Excellent. Really007@gmail.com. See, I'm the most au fait with the intros, so we'll get straight through it. Firstly, how are you, John and Chris? Are you okay?
Yep. Very good, thank you. You?
Very good. Very excited to be here.
Excellent stuff. Excellent. Well, I will introduce our guest. This is very exciting for me because I know a lot of you out there will know my day job as a writer. But whenever I get to speak to someone who has actually been writing in the world of James Bond and not just fan fiction like me, actually allowed the keys to the franchise to go and work in this amazing world is a very special day. So without further ado, can I welcome Mr. Raymond Benson to the podcast? How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And hello, everybody out in podcast land.
Yes. Well, we do. We have listeners all over the place. So it's wonderful to share.
So I can't say I've had my six, but I've had my three.
Very good. That's
it. You could definitely say that. This is usually a point where I'd look to the guys and go, we got a good one here, guys. firstly, Raymond, how are you today? And where are we speaking to each other from? I'm in Warrington in the north of England. And you are?
I'm outside of Chicago in the middle of the United States.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
It's a little after 2 o'clock here.
Amazing. And thank you so much for your time. So, I mean... Speaking about the whole picture of your writing career, if we could do that, but how, before we got to James Bond, I mean, were you always a writer? Just in your heart and in your mind, were you always a writer?
No.
Oh.
I was a theater major. I started off really, I think, you know, as a kid, wanting to be an actor, I thought. And, you know, in high school, I was in our drama department and I did act a lot and decided I wanted to be in show business of some kind. And after I graduated high school, I went to the University of Texas at Austin and joined the drama department there to get my degree in theater. After one semester, I decided acting was for the people who were really talented at it. I wanted to be a director. I thought I would be better suited as a director. But I was also a musician. I don't know if you knew that. I composed music. I play the piano. I'd always been composing music. for the next, you know, for the college years and for pretty much 10 years after that, I was a theater stage director and a music composer for theater. After college, I did move to New York City, and I directed stage works there, you know, off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway, off-off-off, way off-Broadway. And I would put music to playwrights' lyrics when they, like, say, wrote a new musical, and these were performed, and I did that for a long time. But then in the 80s, the 1980s, I mean, I'm an old guy, so we're talking about the 70s there. And in the early 80s, I had this crazy idea that I wanted on my bookshelf a book that was, I mean, we had already had a couple of books on the Bond movies, you know, the John Brosnan book and the Stephen J. Rubin book. We had, you know, some biographies of Ian Fleming. We had the John Pearson book and some sort of unauthorized out of print books. We had a couple of books on the Bond novels, like the Kingsley Amis James Bond dossier and you know, a few that came out in the 60s and were long gone. I wanted a book that had all of that in one big book, you know, a brief biography of Fleming, a history of the Bond phenomenon, and analyses of all the books and all the movies, all in one place. And there did not exist a book like that. And my friend said, well, you're going to have to write it, because they knew I was a big, huge Bond fan since childhood. My father had taken me to see, I was 9 years old when Goldfinger came out on the big screen. I persuaded my father to take me to see it. And of course, you know, back then, this would have been probably January of 1965, because it didn't open in America until December of 64. And I lived in a small town in West Texas, and the movies didn't come there for, it took a couple of months. It might've been like February of 65. And then, so, you know, at that age, seeing something like that on the big screen just, you know, blows your mind. And, you know, my libido was kicking in around that time. And it was just, it was hot. It was sexy. It was cool. It was, Sean Connery was, you know, cool as hell. It was just fantastic. And I was immediately a fan. And I started investigating, well, what else is there? And I learned, well, there were two movies before that. And luckily, about 4 months later, 5 months later, they released the double bill of Dr. No and From Russia with Love. And that came to the big screen. So within about six months, I saw the first three movies on the big screen. You know, the paperbacks, the Ian Fleming paperbacks were everywhere at that time. And so I started picking them up, even at 9 years old, and started reading them, even though maybe some of it may have gone a little over my head, but I could get the stories. I was a good reader at the time. I was a very advanced reader. I read the Ian Fleming books at the age of 9 and 10 and kept up with the series and everything all through the 60s. I was right there in the middle of Bond mania and Beatle mania and the whole British invasion thing. I was just really into it. Everything. Swing in London and all that stuff, you know. I was a peculiar kid for West Texas. I was not like everybody else. So, you know, in the early 80s, here we are. I'm now in my, you know, late 20s. I started thinking about this book, you know, could I write something like that? I'd never thought of myself as a writer, you know. But I think I knew the material, but I wanted to do a lot of more research into Ian Fleming, you know. I pitched the idea to a publisher and got a contract to write the book overnight, which is kind of unusual.
What?
Yeah. Wow. But it took me 3 years to do it. I did go to England in 1982, and I met members of Ian Fleming's family and a lot of his colleagues and friends. And, you know, I spent time with Ivor Bryce and Ernest Cuneo and Robert Harling, and I met Peter Jansen Smith, who, you know, who was his literary agent and ran, at the time it was called Glidrose Publications. Now it's called Ian Fleming Publications. I met Kingsley Amis. I met John Pearson. I all these people, and it was fantastic. It was just eye-opening and quite the experience as well. So I went, you know, came back, wrote the book, took a while for it to get published, but finally it came out in 1984 in the United States. It didn't come out in Britain until 1988. But by then, I had updated the original version. And so they used the updated version for the text of the British version. So that kind of turned my career sideways. I was still doing theater, but I suddenly was a writer. And the book was nominated for an Edgar Allan Poe Award and all this stuff. And I got a lot of acclaim for it. And I started getting involved with the American Bond fan club. And they had a magazine called Bondage. Maybe you were familiar with that. Yep. So I started writing articles for that. And I became kind of known as the sort of Bond expert, whatever that is. And I would appear at like these conventions and things like that. Peter Jansen Smith, the guy at Ian Fleming Publications, he and the Fleming family, they liked the book, The Bedside Companion. And we stayed in touch. And I did, little tasks for them every now and then, all through the 80s and early 90s. And this is when John Gardner was writing the books.
Mm,
yeah. But I would, I'd visit him when I came to England and stuff. And then
I'm sorry to ask him, like, can you define tasks a little bit? It sounds serious.
I can't. I probably shouldn't.
Yeah,
there were sort of secret tasks.
Cool.
But anyway, well, one of those I can sort of talk about because now it's well known is that I wrote a stage play based on Casino Royale. It was an adaptation of Casino, because at the time in the mid 80s they still owned the rights for a stage play of Casino Royale. Now the film rights were owned by Columbia because of the 1967 thing. Eon had no rights to it. So actually Glidrose did own what could be called stage rights. So they commissioned me to write the play, and I actually got paid for it, which was a nice thing.
Always a good thing.
Yeah, and we did a staged reading of it in New York City, off Broadway, and it went very well. But then mysteriously, Glidrose decided not to pursue it. And that's it. That was the end of it. So, it's one of those, things that we don't talk about.
what an interesting, even just by itself, the idea of a Casino Royale musical is...
Yeah. No, not a musical.
Not a musical. A stage adaptation.
A serious stage play.
Unbelievable.
I get it.
Very, very faithful to the book. And when you think about it, Casino Royale is probably the only of the only one of the books that could be a stage play.
Yes.
100%.
Definitely. I mean, just hearing your story, I know it's so obvious, but you are just genuinely a fan, aren't you? It's unbelievable. You're an incredibly talented guy, but you are like living the dream. This is a Bond fan who makes a Bond book, and it's an inspiration. That's all I'm trying to get at. It's so good.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was. I was in a unique position. I totally admit it, and I don't take it for granted. But anyway, during this time in the late 80s and early 90s, I got involved in computer games. Totally by accident, because after The Bedside Companion was published, I had gained a literary agent, and the agent had gotten a call from one developer of early computer games. In the mid-80s, you got to remember, this was the infancy of computer games, when Apple IIcs were coming into the homes, and Commodores and things like that.
Yeah.
You guys are too young to remember this stuff.
There's a couple of us going,
This company had a license to do a couple of James Bond games. And my agent, they were looking for a writer. So they contacted this agency that my agent was with, and they said, do you know any writers that might want to do this? And he thought of me. So he called me and said, would you be interested in this? And I said, yeah. So I learned on the fly how to write, this user code for text adventure computer games. And, and those, the first ones were very basic text only games where, it tells a story as you play it. It's the kind of, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Infocom games like Zork.
I remember Zork. Yeah.
They were very popular in the 80s, but they were all text, no graphics, the kind of thing like, you are in a forest. You see a sword on the ground and a path on the east and a path to the west. What do you do? And you type, pick up the sword. It says, you have a sword. Now what do you do? go east, you know, and it unravels a story as you play it and solve puzzles. So I did two Bond games and a Stephen King game to start off with. And then that just, you know, got me more jobs with bigger and better companies up through the mid 90s.
So is this I was just going to ask you, is this sort of you cutting your teeth on sort of narrative, essentially, you know, actually learning the skill?
I was just going to say that that's how I honed my fiction writing. Mm. Because, you know, the scripts for these things, especially when once we got into the 90s with things like Ultima 7, The Black Gate, and Are You Afraid of the Dark, and games like that that were massive worldwide bestsellers. The scripts that I would write were pages, you know, that looked like, you know, the kind of phone books from London back in the 80s. Peter at Ian Fleming Publications, I guess, you know, was following my career like that and was aware that I was, you know, writing fiction. I had actually written a first novel in the late 1980s, a mystery novel, the proverbial first novel, the kind you put in a drawer and never make out of it. But I did let him read it and see, you know, to get, you know, what do you think, Peter? And he had good comments and, you know, didn't think it was terrible, but he agreed with me it should go in a drawer and never come out. But, you know, I think it was, he saw that I could not only start a novel with a premise and characters, but I could finish a novel, you know, and that's a big thing because I know a lot of people who think I'm going to write a novel and they'll write one chapter and quit, you know.
Raymond, you are so right. I say this to a lot of people because I'm lucky enough to teach some creative writing and when anyone who's actually got to the end of a novel, you've done it. You pat yourself on the back. You've got there, you know, because there are so many people who, like you say, start but never finish. And I don't begrudge those people, but I begrudge like how you might have absolute dynamite in there. Finish the darn thing, you know, like get it out there. You know, you might have the next poor multi-million-dollar franchise sitting in your head.
Yep. So anyway, he saw that I could do that. Well, then finally, I'm still working at the computer game company, and it's late 1995. It's early November. It's probably the first week of November. GoldenEye is yet to be released in like 3 weeks. He calls me from England, and he says, Raymond, John Gardner has decided to hang up the hat. He's going to retire, and we want to know if you'd like to give it a shot.
Wow.
I had to keep it a secret for a while, but he wanted me to, you know, I had to kind of audition in a way. I had to write an outline of a story on spec. Ooh. That not only Ian Fleming Publications and the Flemings had to approve, but also the British publisher and the American publisher, because they both had their, you know, claws into this. Once that was done, I had to write the first four chapters on spec. Once that was done, then I got the contract and it was announced. And that was, by then it was spring 1996.
Well, I mean, was it a kid in a candy store moment when you were like at the, you know, keys in hand and you are keys beneath your fingertips and you're like, I'm writing James Bond here. And I'm going to, you know, like I've been asked to write about that character. Like those must have just been, I mean, how did it feel?
It was terrifying in a way. I mean, I was confident enough that I knew I could do it. I was terrified, though, because it was going to be a challenge. It was going to be hard work. And, you know, and I'm American, you know, and, you know, he said, you know, well, you know, we'll be sure to vet it for, you know, any Americanisms that slip in and everything. But you've got to write British. You have to do it as if you're British. I went, oh, okay. So I started coming over to England a lot while I was writing the Bond. I was over there three or four times a year to soak it all up, you know, and soak up the language. And, you know, at first we discussed what direction my books would go. You know, we were thinking series, you know, already, you know, what direction should we go in? Should I continue contemporarily like John Gardner did, you know, set them in the current day? Or should we go back in time, go back to the 50s or the 60s? And then GoldenEye came out. You know, that was huge. It was a big hit. And it kind of, you know, rebooted the franchise. And Peter said, you know, I think we should stay in sync with the films. And in fact, we want you to make your M a woman. And, you know, he said, I think, you know, stay contemporary, make your books a little more like, you know, the Eon movies, you know, a little more action, a little more humor. And I said, well, that's fine, but I really want to make, I want to keep my Bond Fleming's Bond. I want him to have all of his vices intact. I want him to still be a drinker, a smoker, a womanizer, all that stuff. And Peter thought, well, you know, it might be anachronistic now, but if you can make it work, fine. That's how I approached it. I put, you know, what I saw as Fleming's Bond into sort of the Pierce Brosnan era world universe. And that's what my books were.
So when you were thinking of like plot points, obviously like with GoldenEye, that's set very much in its time. Were you kind of scouring kind of like, you know, current affairs, you know, you were trying to plant it just there and then and kind of have that influence?
Yes. Well, basically what I would do would, I would look at a map of the world and see what hotspots Britain was concerned about. Mm-hmm. And once I've pinpointed a spot, then I would do a little research into the history of why it was a hotspot and come up with a storyline based on that. So, you know, the very first book, I knew that if it were published, it would be 1997. And what was the big event that year? It was the handover of Hong Kong.
Yeah.
So, you know, I cleared it with Peter. I said, what if I do Hong Kong? And he said, that sounds great. So I wrote an outline and a storyline based on Hong Kong. And I traveled, you know, to Hong Kong and China and Macau to do the research. That was in 96. In spring of 96, and, you know, wrote it all through that year while I was still working at the computer game company. I didn't quit my day job until the book came out, till Zero Minus 10 was published in April of 97. And then from then on, I've been a freelance author.
Wow.
And the run, I mean, like, so this is an unheard of 5 years you had where there was, so is it three? In terms of just Bond, we're talking about here, three short stories and nine novels. I know
six originals and three movie novelizations.
It between 97 and 02, that's 12 published works in 7 years.
Yeah. Well, I count 96 because that's working all the way through.
Okay. When you were working on it. But I mean, that's just an astonishing.
Yeah.
Run of work in a comparatively short amount of time. I mean, like if you look at 99, you had four in 99. Two of them were full novels. It's just crazy.
I know. I was really pulling my hair out that year.
I can imagine. Once you'd done Zero Minus 10, was it like, I know you mentioned that you were already thinking of this in terms of series potential, but when did it become like apparent that you were going to be, you know, doing novelizations for the movies as well?
Basically, whoever was the author of record was the one who did the novelizations, which is why John Gardner did License to Kill.
Right.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So if I had, if I was sitting in the seat, then I would be the one. By spring of 97, they all knew that I could do it. I'd written 0-10. And so immediately after that book was published, I started working on Tomorrow Never Dies because they were filming it. The novelizations had to be into the publisher 5 months prior to publication. So that means I had from about April to June to write Tomorrow Never Dies. The novelizations are quick works.
Oh my word!
Right, not just in the world of James Bond, but I've not met many people who do, you know, movie novelizations, and I think they can be such fabulous companion pieces to a movie that you might already love, and that flesh out that world even more. But how does it work? I mean, do you get the script,
Eon sent me the script. But as they, you know, because they were filming still while I was writing, they would fax me changes to the script every day. And they were still filming. They were still filming when I finished. So that's why my three novelizations are slightly different.
Yeah.
A little bit, you know. And also I added some stuff to it. I got permission from Eon to, like, say in Tomorrow Never Dies, I added a Weylin backstory.
Yeah.
You know?
What was she doing there in Hamburg? You know, what was her backstory? What brought her there in search of Carver? You know, so I fleshed that out. You know, that wasn't in the script.
One of the things that got me kind of reading as a young age was novelizations. There was particularly for films that I wasn't allowed to actually watch yet. So things like Terminator and Alien that I couldn't watch, I'd buy the novelization. It was probably worse, to be honest with you, obviously with your own imagination. But I always found them, like I collect them whenever I can, because like Rob was saying, it's such a fascinating artifact of maybe the first early drafts were, and then you've got the influence of the writer, and then obviously you've got the final cut that maybe doesn't quite, you know, match it. So I always love going back to films that I'm familiar with and finding the novelization and go, wow. Right. Like I say, you get to flesh out those bits where you just don't have either the running time or was caught or was never actually written. And I always love that. It's like putting meat on the bones for me, novelizations. And there's always like a scene that you're like, this isn't in the film. when did this happen? And then I've always kind of loved it. And also the process, like you say, getting that script and how that evolves, because obviously filming a script is very different to writing a novel. So it must have been, like you say, it must have been quite stressful trying to keep up with those constant changes.
Right. Well, you know, they were fun to do, but, you know, it was the original novels that really I was put my heart and soul in.
Yeah.
And they took a year each, you know, because I would travel to all the locations and I spent a lot of time, you know, working out the plot and writing it. And
I'm so excited. It's just there's questions popping out the top of my head constantly. Like, so a common question asked, you know, whenever I find myself talking to an author is about planning or pantsing. You know, how far do you... especially with Bond, need to remember we are in a James Bond podcast. So, like, especially when it comes to your Bond original novels,
plotter or pantser, and that's a good thing because, you know, I belong to several writers' organizations, Mystery Writers of America and International Thriller Writers, and the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's all novel guys that do novelization. People that do
that's
novelization.
Cool.
There's this, you know, we refer to ourselves as either plotters or pantsers. And that is, you know, you either plot beforehand or you just write by the seat of your pants. And I'm a plotter. I'm definitely a plotter. You know, Ian Fleming Publications required an outline before I started.
Right.
That was part of the deal. You know, they wanted to see what I was going to write. So I began by, you know how Alfred Hitchcock did storyboards before he would shoot a movie?
Yeah.
They were picture. He would draw out the movie that he saw in his head on paper, you know, frame by frame, just about. Well, my outlines are the prose equivalent of a storyboard. They're broken out in block paragraphs in prose, and each block paragraph represents a chapter. What happens in that chapter, plot-wise, story-wise? And that's what I would do. And I would spend a lot of time doing this. I'd work out all the kinks and all the red herrings and the twists and the turns and the obstacles. And I would spend maybe 2 months or more on just a 20-page outline.
Wow.
And so I would get it perfect so that it becomes the map. It's the guide for writing the book, the blueprint, so to speak. It's like, you know, I look at, you know, writing the novel is building the novel. And you got to have your blueprints to build a building, right?
Yeah.
So it's the blueprints for the novel. It doesn't mean I can't change some things. If I'm in the middle of writing chapter 10 and I realize, oh, it would be kind of cool to do this, I can do that. You know, I can change the outline a little bit if I want to. So, and I've done that. That's what I do first. And I've done that with all my work ever since, even my own stuff. I admire people who can be pantsers. I mean, I don't know how they do it. Stephen King's probably the most famous pantser. He just sits down and writes. Ian Fleming was a pantser. I mean, yeah. he had a good idea of what he was going to do. You know, he had done some research beforehand and done all the sort of legwork. Like, for example, for Diamonds Are Forever, he traveled across America with Ernest Cuneo and went to Las Vegas and did all that stuff and had all that stuff in his head and notes and stuff. But then when he started to write, he didn't have an outline. He just sat down and wrote.
That's amazing. So I would imagine then when it came to a movie tie-in, the plan is the script, I suppose, you know, that you can always refer back to and that kind of thing.
Right.
And
I didn't do an outline for the novelization.
I was going to say, that's amazing. So, and I hope this is acceptable to say, I'd just like to say it while I have the writer in front of me. I thought the Die Another Day novel that you did as the movie tie-in outstripped the film by miles and miles. I thought it was fabulous.
Yes.
The tie-in novel you did.
Thank you.
So, it was brilliant. And it was more than a companion piece. On this occasion, this was like, so this is what it perhaps could have been like, you know, like that kind of thing. And I have to add at this point that we're people who like the movie.
I don't like to denigrate Eon or anything
of course
like that. I mean,
I'm not asking you to do that.
I love Eon and I love Barbara and Michael and I thought working with them was really great. They've been very good to me. But you know, I was at the premiere party for The World Is Not Enough. And I meet Michael Apted, you know, the director. And, you know, I say, oh, hi, I novelized the movie. I wrote the book of the movie. And he went, oh, well, maybe you made sense of it then.
Oh, my word. So, this past, it's taken us nearly a year, hasn't it, guys? We've been done a deep, deep review dive on Die Another Day. We get, you know, people online sometimes tell us, well, have you looked at the Fleming? Have you gone back to the Fleming? So we introduced the Benson in Die Another Day, our episode. So I kept referring to the Benson while doing this review and saying, well, this is the scene here. Here's the scene how it otherwise could have played out with all that extra backstory and stuff like that. So,
well, Robert Wade and Neil Purvis, they came. It's really them, you know.
Yes.
You know, my hat's off to them. I did work with Robert during the novelization. I would bounce things off him. You know, for example, in the movie, you know, Bond gets from North Korea to Hong Kong like that, still wearing the same clothes.
Oh,
how did he do that?
The story. So did you come up with the story of how he got there?
I said, look, this is a novel. You can't just do a jump cut. You have to explain how did he get to Hong Kong? You know, he's been disavowed. You know, he's on his own. He has no money. What's he going to do? So I have a whole chapter of how he gets to Hong Kong.
And it's one of the coolest Bond chapters ever for me. Like, he goes with nothing to some underground, is it like underground bar, doesn't he? Or underground casino place?
Yeah, something like that. I haven't read it in a long time, so I don't remember all the details.
He does
some sneaky Bond stuff. Thing. You
know? He does, yeah. Basically, he finesses money and a way to get out of nothing, just his wits. It's the most Bond thing I've read. Oh, such a long time. It's so good. And so we get to We've got Zero Minus 10. We've got The Facts of Death. We've got, obviously, yeah. I'll leave the short stories to one side for a moment, but High Time to Kill, Double Shot, Never Dream of Dying, The Man with the Red Tattoo. And do you have one that particularly lives in the memory for you?
Well, they're all like children. So, you know, I love them all. But if I had to pick a favorite, it would be High Time to Kill. You know, that is probably, you know, it's a Bond story that hasn't, I don't think it's been done. You know, it's a mountain climbing story. I'd love to see it filmed. You know, it should be filmed.
I'm going to say it should as well.
When you're kind of dealing with this already pre-existing literary world, you know, whether it's the films or, you know, Ian Fleming's kind of work, you've got kind of, have you got carte blanche where it comes to, can I use that character? Can I bring that character into this story? Or did you have to kind of get permission or, you know?
I just did that. You know, when I would do the outline, if I wanted to use Felix Leiter or Tiger Tanaka, I would just do it. And, you know, Peter would read the outline and approve it. So, you know, I never had an outline rejected. So they always really? Took it. Yeah. He might have had some suggestions, you know, here and there. You know, this little bit right here, maybe do this or something like that. You know, we talked a lot about Marc-Ange Draco, what I did with him. And he totally agreed with me that, yeah, this guy's a bad guy. He was a bad guy to begin with. You know, this makes total sense. That was a little controversial when that book came up.
Really? I love it.
When I'm hearing this, your passion just oozes through. You're a Bond fan, and this is a joy for you to do. And you're thinking at it from the perspective of a fan. You're thinking logically about the characters and all the rest of it. And having, you know, such a prolific bibliography in such a short space of time shows just your passion oozing through. But would you say there was any a time that you found it difficult in terms of the writing? And
it was always difficult. It was always work.
Really?
Yeah. It was always work. Yeah.
Even the traveling, you know, everybody, you know, I'd say, well, I'm going to, you know, France, you know, or Spain to do research. And everybody go, oh, can I carry your bags? You know, that kind of, it was work. It was really was work. I mean, I had a great time and I saw a lot of places I never thought I would see. I met a lot of people that were incredibly interesting and cool, but it was work. I was taking notes. I was taking pictures. I was asking questions. I was making appointments to see people and find out things.
Yeah.
And going from here to there and here to there and taking this train and going, you know, in within a short amount of time that was finite, you know? So it was not leisurely.
No.
It was work. But man, I had some adventures. It was...
what you're describing sounds very James Bond in itself.
Very James Bond.
Well, you know, I like to say I was walking in Bond's footsteps. You know,
I would stay in his hotels,
eat his food. You know, I didn't jump out of airplanes or, you know, bed as women, but I ate his food, so that was fun.
It's as close as we'll get, isn't it, Ray? What about, like, so after, in 2003, I know that you stepped back from the James Bond world. And from then, I mean, your writing career, I tried to count and find everything that you've done. And I just kept going back on myself and finding new things. And your career is storied and huge and ongoing. I mean, just this year, 2023, Sea People, published in the anthology Thrilling Adventure Yarns.
Right.
I mean, you just...
And next week, there's a short story coming out in an anthology of stories inspired by the songs of Elvis Costello.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's called the book is called Brutal and Strange, stories inspired by the songs of Elvis Costello. And my story is The Beat. From this year's model. Yeah.
Cool.
That's so good.
It comes out Monday,
right. We'll make sure we do a shout on Monday.
Yeah, too right.
Yeah. So if you could I mean, because there is so much, and it's all so much variety. Well, you wrote a Pocket Essential book about Jethro Tull as well.
I did.
Yeah, I mean, this is just like the variety here is just monstrous. So is there anything outside of the world? If someone else, if say just to someone who knows you only from the James Bond books, and you were to say, you know what, like I wouldn't mind someone else reading this of mine because I'm particularly proud of it. What might that be for you?
Well, my latest novel, The Mad, Mad Murders of Marigold Way, is right up there, I think. It's won some awards. It's gotten some good notices. It's one of my favorites, and it's wacky. It's a dark comedy that takes place during COVID. It was my attempt to do a Coen Brothers movie in prose.
Amazing. So,
nice.
You know how if you watch the Coen Brothers movies, you know, a lot of their movies are about crime. But the characters committing those crimes are so utterly stupid. I think the Coen brothers make smart movies about stupid people. For smart people. Well, that's what The Mad Mad Murders is. It's about some really stupid people and who try to commit some crimes and all the while COVID is going on around them. And it takes place in my neighborhood.
Oh, really?
I said it in my hometown. I fictionalized it, but there's a lot of truth in this book.
It sounds absolutely amazing. It just got added to my Christmas list, Raymond. So I literally clicked add to list on thinking it's there. So
other than that, I would say my Black Stiletto series. That's really my magnum opus, I think. It's the five books that are... It's kind of like Harry Potter in that it's one big story told in five different books, you know, that are all linked and tell a complete character arc.
Amazing. So
the Black Stiletto is probably my favorite thing that I've written.
Excellent.
I think it's quite obvious that you're also a big cinephile and obviously obviously people can't see this, but you're a Kubrick fan as well, which I'd obviously spotted.
Has
his work influenced your writing over the years?
Absolutely. One of my little sort of side jobs in the last 15 years was teaching film history at a college, nearby college.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm very much a cinephile. I'm a film historian. I lecture every month. I have been for 20 years, you know, at libraries and campuses and things like that on film, and I write for Cinema Retro magazine. You know, Cinema Retro, that's run by Dave Worrell and Lee Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
I've been with that magazine since the first issue. I've always had a column. So yeah, I'm very much into movies and music and theater.
you're a storyteller. You're a fan of stories, and you're a storyteller. You know, it's just absolutely wonderful. Can I ask, what are you working on at the moment, or is it top secret?
Well, in a way, it is secret. I've been for the last year and a half. I've been ghostwriting.
Have you?
I have been. I've done some of that. You know, it kind of goes along with the tie-in work. You know, I've done other novelizations. You know, of video games like Splinter Cell and Metal Gear Solid and things like that. But every now and then I'll get a job where, you know, it's ghostwriting, where you write the stuff and somebody else puts their name on it, but you get paid a lot.
He worked with John Milius.
Very lucrative. And you would be surprised what all is ghostwritten out there. I mean, just about any celebrity biography that's supposedly written by the celebrity is more than likely not written by that celebrity.
and I would imagine more non-disclosure agreements than you know what to do with.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'm quite familiar with the verbiage in an NDA.
Yes. I must admit, I'm still at the point in my career where my ghostwriting work, Raymond, is more lucrative than my actual work under my own name. So,
that's the case. That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, my tie-in work, my novelization work, my ghostwriting work does pay better than my own original work. I mean, I've done okay with my original stuff. Thank you very much. But it does pay a lot more.
Yes. About Bond. If we could just, you know, we talked about you as a writer and about the career and everything like that, and that magical period that you were the literary voice for Bond. You were the Benson. You are the Benson. But what about, like, who's your favorite Bond?
You mean the actor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, I've always said there's Sean Connery and then there's everybody else.
Okay, yeah. cool. There's no argument here, you know, on that one.
You talk to just about any Bond fan, it kind of depends on, you know, what their age is and what their first movie mm-hmm. was and mm-hmm. when they got into it, you know, and that's usually their favorite, you know. My son, GoldenEye, was his first movie, and, you know, he really likes Pierce Brosnan, although he has come to appreciate, you know, the earlier stuff, and now... Mm. I think he's like me. He appreciates Connery the best. You know, I know people who, you know, Roger's their favorite, or Pierce, or even Daniel Craig. I know people who George Lazenby's their favorite.
Yeah.
But, you know, Connery was the first guy I saw. He was the guy I was living with as Bond for many years.
Yeah.
You know, I argue that without him, if Dr. No had not been a success, we would not be here today talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally absolutely.
Totally
so
agree.
True. So true.
You can trace everything back to that moment.
Yeah. 1966, Connery was the number one box office star.
Mm.
And, you know, people today, you know, the younger generation, they don't appreciate that. They don't really understand how big it really was in the 60s. I mean, Bond has always been big, but in the 60s, that was the Star Wars, you know, that was the pinnacle of franchise movie making.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of imitations, but nothing as successful or had the quality of the Bond films in the 60s. And I will always think of, you know, especially the first three as the most significant. Yeah. The most significant and most important Bond films of the entire franchise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think anyone in their right mind could argue against that. I truthfully don't think they could. But
well, you know, you see all these rankings, people ranking their Bond films, you know, and, you know, somebody puts Octopussy at number one, and I'm going, what's wrong with you?
Whoa.
I nearly spat my drink everywhere, Raymond.
I'm gone.
I like Octopussy too. You know, it's fine. It's fine. It's a nice little romp. But as far as, you know, what Bond movies are you going to put in a time capsule to open up 100 years from now that represents what a Bond movie is? And I would put the first three because they were the ones that they were original. They totally created every little element that gets repeated and repeated and repeated and repeated.
I would completely agree. And I think if you don't have the sheer potency, filmic potency of those three films, you don't have everything after that. You know, you don't. It's a franchise that just gets like, hey, those were some nice movies, and that it dies there a death, you know. So another pop quiz. Favorite Fleming novel?
From Russia with Love. Although a close second would be Dr. No. You know, because From Russia with Love ends with that cliffhanger. I'm not sure if somebody said, I'm only going to read one Fleming book, which one should I read? I would be hesitant to say From Russia with Love because of the way it ends. I would probably tell them to read Dr. No, because those two together, I think, are the epitome of Fleming's work. I love Honor, Majesty, Secret Service a lot. I'd probably put that as number three, but there's several that I really love.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to put you on the spot.
I'm sorry. I've been doing that, Phil.
I thought I was on the spot. I wouldn't be here.
I'm so sorry, Chris. Raymond.
Obviously, you know, in terms of the film series, I think it's fair to say it's a clean slate now, a fresh start for whatever comes with it. So does Raymond Benson have a elevator pitch for the Eon production? Which way do we go?
Yeah, well, you know, it's what a lot of people are suggesting, but they probably won't do it, is to go back to the 50s and, you know, do a period Bond. They won't. I don't think they will. I mean, I don't know. I don't like to speculate what Eon will do.
So you would like to see that? You'd like to see?
I would personally. Yeah, I would like to see that.
Kick it off again back there.
Yeah. I mean,
what would excite you about going back to the 60s and doing that? What would it be about that?
Well, it would be closer to what Fleming wrote, I think. Mm-hmm. It would, you know, capture that period of time, which was what the original books were. Of course, they wouldn't be able to do all the product placement and things like that.
No,
that would be a, that would be, that's why they won't do it. I don't think, you know, I don't know. I don't know what they're going to do.
Well, I imagine smoking would be a big issue as well.
You know, you see, there are movies that take place in that time period and people smoke. So I don't know. It's yeah, it's a whole new world.
But if you were given, if the phone rang, would you answer the call?
Well, it does. It continues to ring because, you know, 0-10 just got.
Yes, of course. Yeah,
absolutely. Fact,
we should talk about that. Yeah. In fact, let's end on a great big plug for 0-10 because it's been beautifully repackaged.
Yeah, I was really pleased with it. You know, this year is the 70th anniversary of Casino Royale, and Ian Fleming Publications decided to also, you know, relaunch 0-10, Colonel Sun, and the John Pearson biography of 007. Yeah, so we launched them basically at the Pinewood Studio event on October 29th, all three books. And, you know, it was great. Charlie Hickson was there, Kim Sherwood was there, and Steve Cole was there, as well as Nicholas Shakespeare and Andrew Lycett, who were also interviewed. We had Thomas Wheatley and Madeline Smith there to read excerpts from the books.
Incredible.
It was a wonderful day. It was really a nice event. And hats off to Gareth Owen and his team for doing that.
Amazing. Amazing. If I could only just echo what's been said, or your passion is just shines through. And also, I've spent the whole hour, my cheeks hurt from smiling. I've enjoyed this so much. So thank you so, so very much, Raymond, for coming and spending time with
you're
us.
Quite welcome.
I know you mentioned before that you'd like to go back to the time of the Fleming. I'd like to go back to the time of the Benson, if you don't mind, please.
Get the Benson.
Get the Benson. So thank you so much for your time. And we'll certainly be shouting about your upcoming works, the re-release of 0-10 as well. Yeah, just thank you so, so very much.
Yeah,
thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
To talk to you, honestly, love your books, love your work, love the stuff you did with Bond, love the stuff you've done elsewhere. It's just a great pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much, man.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Yeah. All right, thanks for having me. Really the best.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.